Loving Heavenly Father, again we thank you for the opportunity to come together to worship your holy name on this holy day. Be present with us as we study your word. Lead us and guide us in truth. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, the genesis of this little mini-series of three talks came when I was discussing with Brother Newhart the state of the church. I said, "What's your remedy?" And he says, "Get back to basics." So that raises the question, what basics? Well, you know, the church has 27 doctrines, and then we added a 28th. So now we have 28 in the book, What Seventh-day Adventists Believe. And if you look at Ellen White's writing, she identified five pillars, but I've narrowed it down to two. And I said, well, I can't think of anything more basic than what the name of the church represents. As you know, in the early days, in the 1860s, when the church was being formed, there was a discussion about the name of the church. And one of the names which was favored was the Church of God. But then somebody sometime came up with the name Seventh-day Adventists, and that represents right on the two pillars right there of what are the outstanding characteristics of this church. We believe in the seventh day of the Sabbath of the fourth commandment, and we believe that Jesus is coming soon. So that really is what I would call the basics of the basics of the basics. And so that's why we're doing that this morning. And so we're starting with the seventh day, which, as you know, starting with the creation story in Genesis 2, we have the conclusion. One might even say the climax of the creation week. You might say the climax is on the sixth day when Adam and Eve were made. But there's also a climax, a chronological climax, on the seventh day. And so some people criticize the seventh day by saying, well, it doesn't say Sabbath there. Oh, wait a minute. It does use the word Sabbath, but it uses it as a verb. When it says God rested, that's the verb Shabbat. Now later, when we come to the fourth commandment in Exodus 20, that verb has been moved over to become a noun, the Sabbath. So God Shabbat rested, and so he did, as you know, at the conclusion of this creation week, he looked over it all, and each day he'd said it was good, it's good, it's good, and then in conclusion, it's very good. And so the world was set up for living and for occupation by Adam and Eve and all the animals of the field and the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, and the beautiful world started out in that condition. And so we often say, two of the things which come over from that unfallen world are the Sabbath, because it was created right at the conclusion of the creation week, and marriage, because Adam and Eve represented the first marriage. And so with all this discussion now about same-sex marriage, I think we ought to look back to the original design. And the original design was before the fallen world occurred, before that took place. Well, let's concentrate on the Sabbath, and let's notice especially what this says about what God did. And it says that he rested, he blessed, and he sanctified. So, it uses the seventh day in verse 2, it uses it twice, and it uses again in verse 3, the seventh day. He sanctified it because in it he rested from all his work. And there's the verb Shabbat. Now, I want you to notice the three actions. Number one, he rested. Why did he rest? He didn't rest because he was tired. He rested because his creation work was complete. And he also rested as an example for us. And so that's the rest. Now, he could have waited 10 days, 15 days, 20 days to rest, but he didn't. He chose 6 days of creation, and on the seventh day, he rested. That's the kind of the punctiliar action that brings the creation week to a conclusion. And then he blessed it. And keep that blessing in mind, because there is a special blessing for those who keep and worship on and rest on the seventh day. So you are blessed here today as we are worshiping now. And then I want you to especially notice this verb sanctify. Really, it's I don't like that translation so specifically. It's the word holy, but it's the word holy in a causative form. To make holy. And so that seventh day was made holy, not for God himself. He was already holy. He's the one that made it holy. He made the seventh day holy. And that holiness has never been removed. There is no scripture anywhere in the Old or New Testament which says the blessing on the seventh day or the rest on the seventh day for us or the making of the seventh day holy, it has not been removed. Nor has it been transferred to any other day. Now, I want you to look at an unusual text, Genesis 29. Because, you see, we say the Sabbath comes with creation and creation comes with the Sabbath. But you can also say the week, the creation week, happened to be, as indicated here in Scripture, 7 days, a 7-day week. Now, you may think, well, that's well known, and I've seen lists. Perhaps you've seen this big chart. The Quiet Hour used to print it. It has about 40 different languages in which the word Shabbat is used for the seventh day. But there were other weeks. The Greeks and Romans had an 8-day week. It wasn't really a week. It was a market day. They called it noondene, and which really means the ninth day, but it happened to be the fall on the eighth day. So the Greeks and Romans, if you want to say that, they had an 8-day week, and the Egyptians had a 10-day week. So you see, the 7-day week, which the world observes today, is a gift that runs all the way back from to creation when God gave it. So the week and the Sabbath run together. The Sabbath marks off the seventh day of a 7-day week. And so I want you to look at Genesis 29, which is the story about Jacob and his work for his wives. And you'll notice in verse 18, he works 7 years. I will serve 7 years for your daughter Rachel. And he says it again. And so then it says he did in verse 20. He served 7 years. And then, of course, he was tricked by his father-in-law and gets the wrong wife. And so notice especially verse 27. Complete her week, the week of this one, and we will give you the other. Notice the word week there. It is the word Shavuah, not the word Sheva for seven. It's the word for week. So right here in Genesis 29, we have a testimony that the patriarchs were observing a 7-day week, and therefore with it goes the Sabbath. And so we have an indirect reference to the Sabbath here in Genesis 29. Now let's march ahead to Exodus 16, which also was, I want you to notice, before Sinai. And you know the story well. It's about the giving of the manna. And so God gives the instructions about the giving of the manna, that there will be a certain amount each of the 6 days. And on the sixth day, there will be a double portion. And you're not to... then there will not be none on the seventh day. So 5 days, 5 work days, standard dose of manna for each person. 6th day, double dose. 7th day, no work, no gathering. Observe the Sabbath. Use the food that God has already provided, has prepared for you. So you see, the 6th day, even in Exodus 16, was the preparation day. And you were prepared by getting a double dose of manna. Now, this started here in Exodus 16 before we get to Sinai. And it continued for 40 years. You know, they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. They weren't supposed to, but because of a lack of faith of going into the promised land, they wandered for 40 years. And during that 40 years, then, the manna fell every day. In fact, when you come to the book of Joshua, it tells you when the manna stopped. So 40 years, they had a miracle each week, and each preparation day and each Sabbath was marked, not by themselves, not by their calendar on the wall, but by God Himself in the giving of the manna and the holding of the manna. Now then we come to Exodus 20, and you know the commandment there in verses 8 to 11 very well. And remember how this commandment came to us. It was written on tables of stone. And who wrote it? God Himself wrote it. Now, in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, we have one case, one example of something God wrote. And here it is in Exodus 20 with the Ten Commandments. And in the New Testament, we have almost even less, because we have one case when Jesus wrote. And that's when the woman taken in adultery was brought before Him, and He reaches down and He writes in the dust of the earth. So we have one episode where God wrote on stone with His very own hand, and in one episode in the New Testament. And we should pay close attention. God gave these commandments written by His own hand. And so I suppose if He was going to change anything, He should have erased it with His own hand and put a new commandment there if He was going to. But He did not. Therefore, the Ten Commandments, as they stand and carry through all of history down to today, are with us. Now, it's interesting how emphatic the book of Exodus is about the Sabbath. Because it doesn't just occur in the fourth commandment in Exodus 20. But it occurs again in Exodus 31, that's verses 12 to 17, and that's a very long passage. It has six verses about the Sabbath, because they are getting ready to do the work on the sanctuary. And then it occurs again in Exodus 34, 21, and then it occurs again in Exodus 35, verse 2. So in the book of Exodus, four times we have the fourth commandment of the Sabbath. Exodus 20, Exodus 31, Exodus 34, and Exodus 35. Now, why was God so emphatic? After all, He said it once. And so, He didn't need to say it again. We should listen to what He says. We don't have to listen over and over again. We should hear it the first time, which they did, and which they responded to, if you recall. But remember what their task was. The first half of the book of Exodus is about leaving Egypt, and the second half of the book of Exodus is about building the sanctuary. And first it gives you three or four chapters about how to build the sanctuary, and then it gives you three or four chapters of saying that they built the sanctuary the way they were instructed. Now that's a good example of ancient writing style, parallelism of these statements. You see, we would say, well, now here's the way I want you to build the sanctuary, and give three chapters of details, and then say, and they went and did it. But that's not the way they wrote in ancient times. It's known as parallelism of thought. And so they repeated it over again as they built it, the instructions to build it, carrying out the instructions to build it. And it's the same with the Sabbath. We don't just have one commandment, one reference. We have four references to the Sabbath. And one of the reasons for the extra references is because of the holiness of the Sabbath. You see, the people were building a sanctuary. And Exodus 25:8, the verse that you know so well, let them build Me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. I mean, what is more holy than having the dwelling of the personal God with you in His house there in front of you? And you might say, look, this work is so holy that we can even do this kind of work on the Sabbath because we're building a holy sanctuary for God to dwell in. Is that what God says? No. Right when he gives the instructions about building, that's when he gives the instructions about keeping the Sabbath. Even while you are building my holy sanctuary, I want you to keep my holy day the way I have prescribed for you. Now, our Sabbath school lessons these days are about the prophets. But they're the minor prophets, but we're only going to look at the major prophets. And all of the major prophets refer to the Sabbath. And I want you to look, first of all, at Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 56. Now, Isaiah is a very interesting prophet. He sometimes is called the gospel prophet because there are at least 7 messianic prophecies in the book of Isaiah. 3 in the first half of the book, 3 in the second half of the book. And so, very interesting as you look at those. The 3 prophecies in the first half of the book are about the royal Messiah. And the 3 prophecies in the second half of the book are about the suffering Messiah. And so the Jews were confused enough about this. Some of them even believed they were going to have 2 Messiahs. They were 1 Messiah and they only looked at the first half of the book. They didn't look for the suffering Messiah, which came together with the one who should have been accepted as the royal Messiah then. Well, this royal Messiah comes with a Sabbath. And it's given in a very interesting way in Isaiah 56, because Isaiah is not only called the gospel prophet, he is sometimes called the prophet of universalism. That is to say, he looked for the salvation that God gave to extend as far as the islands of the sea. And so the Sabbath here in Isaiah 56 is not just for the Jews, but it is for others. Let's read a little bit of it. Isaiah chapter 56, verse 2. How blessed is the man who does this, and the son of man who takes hold of it, who keeps from profaning the Sabbath, and keeps his hand from doing any evil. And then it continues, let not the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say thus and so. And the eunuch, it even mentions the eunuchs, the Assyrian eunuchs. To the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths and choose what pleases me and hold fast my covenant. And again in verse 6, also the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord to minister to him and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, everyone who keeps from profaning the Sabbath and holds fast the covenant. So the Sabbath and the covenant go together, and the 10 words, the 10 commandments are sometimes called the 10 words of the covenant. So you'll notice the Sabbath here in Isaiah 56 is not just for ethnic Jews, not just biological Jews. It is for foreigners too. So this is the prophet of universalism who sees the Sabbath in a universal context for foreigners to keep it. Now, we continue in chapter 58. And here you have a question at the beginning of the chapter. What is the fast? That's verses 4 to 6. What's the fast? What's the fast that we should keep? And then the Lord tells them what the real fast is. It's not so much abstaining from food, but doing goodness and kindness and mercy to your neighbors and your friends and those whom you meet, to loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the hands of the yoke, and to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke. Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry? This is the true fast. And bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see him naked, to cover him and not to hide yourselves from your own flesh, then your light will break out like the dawn. So here's the true fast. But then at the end of this chapter, after we discussed what they were asking about the fast and finding out what the true fast is, then we come to the Sabbath. The Sabbath is not changed. That is to say, it's a day for doing good. but it still remains in place. Verse 13, if because of the Sabbath you turn, if you turn your foot away from the Sabbath, from doing your own pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the Lord, verse 14, this is an if-then prophecy. If you keep the Sabbath in the way that I want you to, it will be a delight. And then verse 14, the then clause, then you will take delight in the Lord, and I will make you ride upon the high places of the earth. So here in chapter 56, again in chapter 58, we have the Sabbath for foreigners, even for foreigners, a universal Sabbath, and we have the Sabbath as a delight, and God claims it again as my holy day. Remember, He made it holy back in Genesis 2:1-3. Now, Exodus 20 has a text that we'll pass over because you know it so well. It says, I gave them my Sabbath that I might sanctify them. Again, let's translate that word sanctify into holy. That on the Sabbath, by keeping the Sabbath, God endeavors to make you a more holy person. You keep the holy day and become a holy person. Now, I want to show you the importance of the Sabbath. And so we're going not to Ezekiel, but to Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 17. And this is another one of those conditional prophecies, if there's an if clause and a then clause. And so there's an if in one condition and a then in that condition and an if in another and a then in that. And so this is about Jerusalem. It talks about the forefathers in Jeremiah 17, verse 22 and verse 23. Yet they did not listen or incline their ears and so forth. But it will come about. Now, what's the lesson? If the forefathers didn't listen and evil came upon them, what is the lesson? What is the lesson for the Jews of Jeremiah's time? But it will come about if, there's the if clause, you listen attentively to me to bring no load in through the gates of this city on the Sabbath day, but keep the Sabbath day holy by doing no work on it. Then, here's the then clause, then there will come through in through the gates of this city kings and priests sitting on the throne of David, riding in chariots and horses, and they and their princes and the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and this city will be inhabited forever. Was it inhabited forever then? No. This is a prophecy given as Nebuchadnezzar's troops are either outside the wall or approaching the city. And unfortunately, they destroyed it after a three-year siege. So, the warning is now given. See, this is the blessing you could have had. If you do this, if you keep the Sabbath holy, you will remain as an independent kingdom with your own kings riding in their own chariots, and it will be free forever. But, now, verse 27, if you do not listen to me to keep the Sabbath day holy by not carrying a load and coming in through the gates of the city, Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, then I shall kindle a fire in its gates and it will devour the palaces of Jerusalem and not be quenched. So, you see, your holiness and participation in the Holy Sabbath at this time, in 597 and 586 B.C., depended upon what was going to happen to the city of Jerusalem. Can you imagine it? How important the Sabbath was to God. That if they're not going to keep the Sabbath, and they're just going to do their own work, and so carry out as normal, the city, God will let it go, and Nebuchadnezzar conquers it. And that is indeed what happened. So here's the conditional prophecy. If you do this, you get the blessing. If you do this, you get the curse. You get the bad results. And unfortunately, they got the bad results. The city was conquered and destroyed. So that's a lesson for us. Now, could the Sabbath be so important in Old Testament times that God says the survival of the city of Jerusalem depends upon your holy response to a holy day and to me in that day. And they failed. And the city was destroyed. Could it have been that important in Old Testament times and completely forgotten and neglected in New Testament times? An object of this great importance surely must continue in its obligation. Well, there's an interesting one in Nehemiah chapter 13, and this is about, you know, Nehemiah was a great worker for God. And the first half of the book of Nehemiah tells about how he got the city walls up. But then the city walls were abused by foreigners and by Jews themselves of doing business on the Sabbath. So the walls that he had had his crews build, the gates were shut on the Sabbath. So they couldn't come in and do business. And so you can not only call Nehemiah a great worker for God in rebuilding the city of Jerusalem, which we just read about how it came to be destroyed, an element in it, but we can also see that he was a great Sabbath reformer. The Sabbath was meaningful and important to Nehemiah, this great worker for God. All right, we're turning now. That's our brief survey of the Old Testament. Now let's see what happens in the New Testament. Well, the first one is in Mark chapter 1. And this is a simple illustration of when the Sabbath begins and ends. Because Jesus is at Capernaum, verse 21, Mark chapter 1, verse 21. They went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and began to teach. So that's one thing that the Sabbath is for, is teaching. And that's why we have a Sabbath school in which we have classes in which we teach the Bible from one cover to the other. And if you'll notice then down in verse 2, when evening had come, the sun had set, and they began bringing to him all who were ill and those who were demon-possessed, and the whole city had gathered at the door. Why did the city wait until the sunset? Because the Sabbath was over. The holy day had been kept, even for their ill and demon-possessed. And now the Sabbath is over. They come to let Jesus do his work. And he does. Now, you may also remember that Jesus healed on Sabbath. In fact, there's one case here. There actually are seven Sabbath healing miracles in the Gospels. And I'll just read off the list to you. Two of them are in the Gospel of Mark, that's chapter 1 and chapter 3, verse 15. Two of them are in the Gospel of Luke, that's chapter 13 and chapter 14. And one is in Matthew, that's chapter 12. But I especially like the two in John. John chapter 5 and John chapter 9. Because it's interesting how Jesus does these. John chapter 5 is the healing of the paralytic. And you know, he was lying by the pool of Bethesda. And he couldn't make it over because he was a paralytic. His muscles didn't work. His arms and legs wouldn't pull him or push him over to the edge of the water. And they had the tradition that if you were the first one in the water or to touch the water, you'd be healed. But he couldn't make it. And so Jesus meets him on Sabbath and says, "Would you be healed?" And he thinks Jesus is going to be the one that's going to carry him over to the water and get there first. Must have looked like a fairly strong man. But Jesus says, no, that's not what I'm talking about. And he says, "Rise, take up your bed, and walk." Notice how he does it. By the spoken word. How did Jesus create in Genesis 1? By the spoken word. He spoke and it stood fast. And each day it says, "God said, God said, God said." And so this healing in John 5 mirrors the creation in Genesis 1. Then John chapter 9 is different. And this is the blind man. And you know the unusual way in which Jesus treated him. He spits on the dust of the earth, and he gathers up what his spittle has collected and rubs it on the eyes of the man, of the blind man. And then he tells him, go wash in the pool of Siloam. Now, we don't know exactly where this took place, but let's say it was somewhere near the temple. To get to the pool of Siloam, you have to walk downhill, and at that time they didn't have good roads, and so you had to walk down stone steps, and that was not very easy for a blind man. And it's a fairly long walk. At least when I walk it, coming back up the hill, I'm puffing by the time I get to the top of the hill. So he goes down and he washes his, he has enough faith. He says, I'll do this. And he washes his eyes, and then his eyes are opened. And the first thing he probably saw was the sunshine glittering on the water in front of him. Jesus, the water of life. Now I want you to notice especially how Jesus healed there. He didn't speak. He didn't put his hand on the top of the man's head. He didn't anoint him. He just put clay where the damaged part of his body was. Now, if you recall the continuation of the creation story in Genesis chapter 2, you may remember how God created Adam. He got down and he worked with the dust of the earth, or the clay, and then he breathed in it the breath of life. We'll study that this afternoon, by the way. But in this case, Jesus works with clay, like he did in Genesis 2 when he made Adam, but he doesn't make the whole form of a human being and then breathe breath. He only puts the clay where the damaged part of the body is. And so, John chapter 5 is a Sabbath day healing which mirrors the creation in Genesis chapter 1. And John chapter 9 is a healing which was performed in a way to parallel the creation of Adam back in Genesis 2, the specific details. And you see, he didn't need to make a whole man, he just needed to make over the eyes. So Jesus is saying, not just the Sabbath day is a day for me to carry out my healing, but it is also a day which reflects back to the original creation. That's what the Sabbath was a memorial of. And Jesus mirrors that in John 5 and John 9. Now you know that when some of these Sabbath healing miracles took place, the religious leaders of the time decided, this man has got to go. We've got to do away with him. And so, you see, they said he was breaking the Sabbath by performing healings on the Sabbath day. Actually, if you want to read John 5, you will see his defense. He summons the different witnesses, so to speak, all the way down to Moses and the Scriptures. All right, so we need to go to Mark chapter 2. How could Jesus do this if this supposedly, according to the Pharisees of the time, was contrary to the commandment? And so, we have in verses 27 and 28, Jesus' comment about the Sabbath. And he was saying to them, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Consequently, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. In other words, he is Lord of that day. Really, he could do with it what he wanted. If he wanted to change it, he could. He's the Creator. He's the Creator that created up to that Sabbath day. But he didn't. He says he's the Lord of the Sabbath day, and he can use that Sabbath day in ways that are pleasing to him. And he carries out these healings as a symptom or a sign of the mercy and grace that he had for fallen and suffering human beings. And so we run hospitals that have to take care of the sick on the Sabbath day. And Jesus even points this out. he talks about if you had a donkey that fell in the ditch, Wouldn't you pull them out on the Sabbath day? Now, there were groups of Jews who would not. The Essenes, who lived down at Qumran, at the monastery at Qumran. If their donkey fell in the ditch on the Sabbath, they'd leave him there until the sun went down. Now, the Pharisees would pull the donkey out. So there was a split in the different interpretation there. But here Jesus says, He is Lord of the Sabbath. Now, that incidentally has a testimony to Jesus as creator. And there are four New Testament texts that talk about Jesus as creator. You know them well. You know three of them well, anyway. John chapter 1, verse 3. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, especially verse 2. And Colossians verses 16 and 17. I'll add one more to that. And let's look at 1 Corinthians 8, verse 6. 1 Corinthians 8, verse 6. 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 6. Yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for Him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and we exist through Him. Another text that you can add to the other three about Jesus as Creator. Well, let's look at the sequence. Incidentally, Mark 15, verse 42, calls Friday, the day on which Jesus died, the preparation day. And that's the preparation day for us still. You prepare for the Sabbath on the day before the Sabbath, Friday. But let's look at Luke to see the historical sequence that happened, that is described by Luke at the time of the crucifixion. Luke 23 and verse 56. All right, Jesus dies on the cross. He says he commits his spirit to God in verse 46. And then you'll notice verse 54. And it was the preparation day, and the Sabbath was about to begin. Now the women who had come with him out of Galilee followed after and saw the tomb and how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and perfumes, and on the Sabbath day they rested according to the commandment. What commandment? Well, you all know very well, it's the fourth commandment. Can you imagine it? Here's the Messiah. And the Messiah, the Holy Messiah, has died. And yet they observe the Sabbath and wait till the Sabbath has passed to complete his burial rituals. They don't use the Sabbath for those rituals. They wait until the Sabbath is over. And then, chapter 24, verse 1, but on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they came to the tomb, bringing the spices which they had prepared, and they found the stone rolled away. And when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. And so forth. You know the rest of the story. But I want you to notice the sequence. The sequence right here at the end of Luke 23 and the beginning of Luke 24. Jesus dies on the preparation day, Friday. They return and rest on the Sabbath. Sunday morning, first day of the week, they come to the tomb to complete the burial ritual with all the spices and herbs that they had. But so you have Friday, Saturday, Sunday, sixth day, seventh day, first day. And Jesus, like they rested in the city, Jesus rests in the tomb. And so you have another parallel here to the creation week. God rests from his work of creation on the seventh day, and Jesus, the Creator, rests from his work of redemption on the Sabbath day. You'll notice that the first day is not referred to as anything special. It does not have a special blessing with it. It does not say you're supposed to keep it. You're not supposed to work on it. This day is holy. None of those are present here with the four references to the first day of the week on when Jesus early came out of the tomb. Luke 4:16 is one that you know well. Jesus, while Jesus was alive during his ministry, he went into the synagogue at Nazareth, and it says, as was his custom. And so the book of Hebrews says, keep going to church, brothers. I'm paraphrasing. So much the more as you see the day approaching, as the second coming, which we will talk about next, comes closer. We're not supposed to abandon the fellowship of the saints. We're supposed to come to the fellowship of the saints more and more to prepare for that day. And what better time to meet in the fellowship of the saints, in the church, in the meal, on the Sabbath day. No wonder it makes you holy. Now, there's a very important one, and it's Matthew 24, verse 40. People say, well, there isn't any commandment in the New Testament about keeping the Sabbath. Well, I'm afraid there is. Matthew 24, verse 20. Jesus gives a prophecy. And the prophecy was fulfilled 40 years after he went back to heaven. He went back to heaven about A.D. 31. And in Roman War, as you know, started in the year 66, and Jerusalem fell in 70. Temple was destroyed, and so on and so forth. And the people were exiled. The Jewish-Roman War finished in A.D. 73. It took them 3 more years to mop up the resistance at places like Masada. Now, what are Christians? What are those who have accepted Jesus as the Messiah? What are they supposed to do during times of war? During that specific time of war? And so he says, but pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. Isn't this a command? At least you're supposed to pray that you won't have to break the Sabbath. Now, we should look at some of the arguments that have been posed against this verse. Some say it was because they were afraid of the Jews. Actually, the Jews in the Mishnah or the Talmud have the provision where you can travel on the Sabbath day in times of stress like warfare. You were permitted to do so in their regulations. Ordinarily, a Sabbath day's journey was about 2.2 miles. And that was actually carried out somewhat in trickery by a group of Jews who were fighting the Romans at the Sea of Galilee. The Roman army had mopped up most of Galilee, but a man informed Titus, the general leading the campaign. He says, there's one nest of Jews over here by the Sea of Galilee that you haven't conquered yet. So he takes his army over there, and when he arrives, the people say, look, we are just now beginning our Sabbath. It's Friday afternoon, Friday evening, our Sabbath starts. We will surrender to you after the Sabbath is over. This is our holy day to worship. And so Titus agrees, and he withdraws his army a mile or two away. And in the meantime, Friday night when it was dark, the Jewish rebels, the zealots of that site, set out on a forced march to Jerusalem. In fact, the men who were going to fight even left their women and children as stragglers behind them, and the women were crying out, help us, help us. But the soldiers just marched on ahead to Jerusalem. This is on the Sabbath. So you see, in the first place, it wasn't so much because of the fear of the Jews. And the second thing they say is, well, you couldn't get out of the city of Jerusalem on the Sabbath because the gates were closed. Well, Nehemiah did that, yes, but you have to look at the changed circumstances in Roman times. Because some of the gates of the city were also the gates of the temple. And so, in order for the people to come into the Sabbath, into the temple to worship, those gates had to be open. And you could go in and out, whether your coming to worship or going from worship. So they were not, the Christians were not penned in the city of Jerusalem on the Sabbath. They had ingress and egress on the Sabbath day. They could come in and go out. So what they did, as we are, as reported to us by Eusebius, the bishop of Caesarea, which was the Roman capital in the early 4th century AD, about 320, Eusebius reports that the Jews in Jerusalem, the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, fled down to the Jordan River. They crossed the Jordan River and they went up the east bank of the Jordan to a place called Pella. And there, incidentally, is a recent archaeological report of 10 years of excavations of Pella, more than 10 years, actually. And so Pella was where they sat out the Jewish-Roman War. And Eusebius reports that not a Christian died in the siege of Jerusalem because they had left. Why did they leave? Because they followed the commandment of Jesus. And when they did so according to the Sabbath commandment. You see, the first attack of the Romans, which for some strange reason never explained, they withdrew when they were right up against the wall of the temple. When that opening occurred, that was middle of fall, late fall. And the Roman army didn't return till the next spring. So they had opportunities to leave the city and to flee on days other than Sabbath and before the winter got severe, because the winter rains come to Jerusalem and Israel in November. That's when the kids go back to school nowadays. So Matthew 24:20 does stand as a commandment or instruction, or however you wish to put it, of Jesus to keep the Sabbath 40 years after his lifetime, his earthly life. Now, I want you to notice the Sabbath keeping in the book of Acts. And we have Acts 13. I want you to just notice the places. In Acts 13, there are three references to the Sabbath. The first Sabbath and then the next Sabbath that he comes back to the synagogue. And that's in Pisidian Antioch, which is in what we would call Turkey today, or Asia Minor. Then there's Acts 16, now that's in Philippi, in Greece, Macedonia. And then Acts 17, the keeping of the Sabbath in Thessalonica. And he could only meet there for three Sabbaths, and he had to leave under pressure. But then in Corinth, chapter 18, he spends a year and a half there and keeps Sabbath regularly there. So I added them up and I came to 78 Sabbaths. So you see, you have three cities in Greece and one city in Asia Minor where the Jews were across the Roman world. Sabbath keeping was known and kept. But I want you to especially notice the one in Acts chapter 16. Acts 16, the one at Philippi. Acts chapter 16, verse 13. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to a riverside where we were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled. So you see, the interesting case is, in other cases, it says Paul goes into the synagogue. And so people say, to excuse Sunday keeping, they say, well, this is just his custom to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath because that's when the Sabbath synagogue met. But that wasn't really why he was doing it according to the commandment. Well, it was, but I want you to notice this one, which disproves that theory, because Philippi, apparently, there was no Jewish synagogue in the city. So he had no Jewish synagogue to go into to evangelize on Sabbath. So where does he go? He goes out by the riverside to keep the Sabbath, to worship, to pray, a place of prayer, and teaches, instructs, pastors, evangelizes the women who are gathered there. And one of them becomes a special disciple of his, as you know. So we have these multiple references to Sabbath keeping throughout the book of Acts. Now, I will tell you a brief experience. I attended the so-called First International Congress on the Sabbath, It was held at the University of Denver, and we had 40 different papers by all kinds of people from all different religious denominations, Catholic Jews, conservative Jews, Reformed Jews, Jesuits, Nazarenes, Baptists, etc., and Seventh-day Adventists. And so an interesting one to me was, we had a Jesuit from San Francisco who said in his talk, it's obvious that in the New Testament, the church, the early church, kept the Sabbath, the whole New Testament. It's obvious, he says. Then he says, but God has given the teaching ministry to the church, so we have been able to change it to Sunday. So that was his response to these biblical texts which we are looking at today. Well, you know, I was the respondent to that talk. And so I said, well, it seems like to me what we should do is keep in the line of what the Bible says. In other words, you see, there's a difference. On the one hand, we say the Bible and what the Bible says, that's what we take. On the other hand, there's Bible plus tradition as a source of revelation. And there's a gap, and there has been a gap ever since the Council of Trent on that point. All right. Now I want to look at three texts that are proposed for Sunday keeping. And the first one is not so much about Sunday keeping, but not keeping Sabbath. And that's Colossians chapter 2, verse 16. There's an interesting backstory to this text. You know of Roger Williams. Roger Williams was a great pioneer of religious liberty. And so he was kicked out of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And so he went down and was one of those instigating in starting the colony of Rhode Island. And Roger Williams considered for a time keeping Sabbath. There is documents on file, which is correspondence between Roger Williams and the Bell Lane Seventh-day Baptist Church in London. And you see, this discussion about the Sabbath goes back and forth in those letters. And Roger Williams finally comes down and says, well, there are many good texts about the Sabbath, but for me it's Colossians 2:16, and so I'm not going to keep the Sabbath. That's the text he finally settled on. Now, what does it really say? And I happen to have a Bible with me, and many Bibles do this, that have mistranslated this verse. Therefore, let no one act as your judge in regard to food or drink, or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day. Wrong. Mistranslation. All right? What does it actually say? In respect to a festival, singular, or a new moon, singular, or a Sabbath day, wrong. It's a plural, a genitive plural. There's only two ways you can translate that. You can translate it as Sabbaths, plural, which it is, or you may not realize this, but that word Sabbath in the genitive plural is used for the word for week. So you see, when you go back to the Gospels and Jesus rises on the first day of the week, he's on the first day of the Sabbaton with a long O. The first day, this is the word that was commonly used for week. And so one way you could translate this is, let no one judge you in regard to a festival, a new moon, or a week. Well, what weeks would the Jews have observed? They observed two special weeks. The Feast of Unleavened Bread was 7 days long. That's a week. So they had a week in the spring following Passover. And in the fall, they had a an 8-day week in which they observed the festival of tabernacles or booths. And so they had a week in the spring and a week in the fall. So it may be George Rice, whom some of you might know, he pastored over here in Maryland, and he just retired recently. He said to me one time, he says, nobody's proved why they haven't can't translate that week. So you could translate it in respect to a festival, a new moon, or a week. That is a legitimate linguistic translation. But I go with the plural Sabbaths. And then I want you to notice something special. I want you to go back to Leviticus 23. Because we have kind of given a shotgun approach to Leviticus 23. And we really need to look at it a little more carefully. So we say, it's plural, ceremonial Sabbaths. Okay, fine. When were the ceremonial Sabbaths? The ceremonial Sabbaths were only in the fall. None of the feasts or special days like Passover, Pentecost, and so forth, in the first part of the Leviticus 2 and 23, down to verse 22, it does not call these ceremonial days, it calls them feasts or days for holy convocation or so on and so forth. It does not call them ceremonial Sabbath. Now, look at these verses. Verse 24, speak to the sons of Israel in the seventh month. Please notice the month, the seventh month. On the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath rest and a reminder by blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. All right, that's the first ceremonial Sabbath. Month of Tishri, seventh month of the year, first day of the month, ceremonial Sabbath. Then look down at verse 32. This is the Day of Atonement now. It is to be a Sabbath of complete rest to you, and you shall humble your souls, and so on and so forth. So here's the second ceremonial Sabbath. And then if you will look at you'll notice that it gives us the Feast of Booths on verse 34. On the 15th of the seventh month, it's the Feast of Booths for 7 days to the Lord. And then you'll notice there's an interval conclusion in verses 37, 38, and it takes up the Feast of Booths again in verse 39. On exactly the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered the crops of the land, you shall celebrate the Feast of the Lord for 7 days, and a Sabbath rest on the first day, and a Sabbath rest on the eighth day. These are the ceremonial Sabbaths of Leviticus 23. They occurred only in the seventh month. Why is that? Because the seventh month became a sabbatical month. We have a sabbatical day, and we have a sabbatical month, and we have a sabbatical year. 7, 7, 7. Now, in this seventh month, we have four ceremonial Sabbaths, all in the seventh month. None of the feasts of the first half of the calendar are ceremonial Sabbath. Now, I want you to notice the progression in Colossians. It says a feast. Where's the first feast? That's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, just after Passover. Or a new moon. There is only one new moon in this calendar. It is on the first day of the seventh month. And then, don't judge you in a feast. If you want to keep unleavened bread, okay. If you don't want to keep it, fine, not a problem. The new moon, new moon of the first day of the seventh month, and then come the ceremonial Sabbaths. And then it says, or Sabbaths, plural. So, you see, it fits the pattern. Paul's remark in Colossians 2:16 fits the pattern of Leviticus 23. That's what he's talking about, Leviticus 23, and he's giving you the parallels, 1, 2, 3, in order. So, you see, it isn't doing away with the seventh-day Sabbath. It's talking about the ceremonial Sabbaths, and we have four of them here. And he says, well, if you want to keep them, fine. If you don't want to keep them, that's all right, too. And remember, these are people in Colossae in Asia Minor. All right, we must finish up, and we need to look. I want to look at one more text before we look in the book of Revelation, and that's 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians 16 is a text which has been used frequently to talk about using Sunday as a day of worship. As a matter of fact, actually the text is exactly the reverse. All right, now Paul, this is Paul's instructions. And what Paul is talking about here is an offering. And the offering is not for the church in Corinth, where the letter was written to. The letter is for an offering for people in Jerusalem. So, are you going to take your offering to church? No, he says, on the first day of the week, this is verse 2. Well, let's go back to the collection. Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, let every one of you put aside and save, as he may prosper, that no collection be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomever you may approve, I shall send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. This is not for an offering for the prosperity of the work in Corinth. This is an offering for the poor saints who are starving because of the famine down in Judea. And he says, figure out your books, what you gained during the previous week, what you gave to the Lord on the Sabbath, and then add it all up on the first day of the week when you start working again and set that aside so that it doesn't become mixed in with all your profits for the next week. And save it there at home. Don't bring it to the church. Don't bring it to the church now. Wait until those whom I appoint come to collect the offering, and they're going to collect the offering here, and they're going to collect the offering in Galatia, and they're going to take it on to Judea. This is not a call to worship on Sunday in Corinth. This is exactly the opposite. In other words, you're going to save up, set aside in your house the collection, and maybe 2 or 3 months later they'll come by and pick up this collection. This is not a Sunday worship text. It's exactly the opposite. Now, let's go to the book of Revelation as we come to the conclusion. Two texts I want to point out to you. The first one is the one that's much talked over, and this is Revelation chapter 1, verse 10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, Kurioike Hamera, and I heard behind me a loud voice like the sound of a trumpet. And then it says write in the things that you've seen and so forth. Now, let's be true with the historical record. By about 180 A.D., the beginning of the church fathers began to refer to the first day of the week as the Lord's Day. That's the beginning, 180 A.D. And then in the 3rd century, it became more common. Now, is that the hermeneutical rule by which we interpret this text? Do we interpret the text according to what the early church father said? Well, it's interesting to see what their observations were, but that's not the hermeneutical rule we use. We're studying the Bible, therefore the hermeneutics say we should use the biblical text. So the question is, what is the Lord's Day, and how do we know? And we looked at one text already, Mark 2:28, and you know what it says. The Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath day. You have those two words right there, Kuriake and Hamera, only they're separated. Now, if you go back into the Old Testament, if you look at Exodus chapter 20, verse 10, another reference, and in particular, one that we just looked at in Isaiah 58. If you turn your foot away from on my holy day, possessive, possession. So God says in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, he says the Sabbath, the seventh day is my holy day. And in the New Testament, Jesus says, I as creator, we've looked at one of those four texts, say the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, I, as creator, am Lord also of the Sabbath day. So we do not use the rule of exegesis from the early church fathers. We use the rule of exegesis from the Bible. And the Bible tells us what was the Lord's day. And the Lord's day was Sabbath, because that's the special day that he possessed. One final text, Revelation 14. As you know, these are the three angels' messages that will be given, are being given, have been given, right up to the end of time. And I want you to notice in particular the first angel's message. First angel's message. And I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who live on the earth and to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. Everybody's supposed to hear this message. What's the message? Fear God, give glory to Him, worship Him, that is, because the hour of His judgment has come, and worship Him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of waters. Now, an interesting reference here. The United Bible Society's Greek New Testament has a reference, a footnote, and cites this phrase, the one who made heaven and earth and sea and springs of waters, directly back to Exodus 20, the fourth commandment, verses 8 to 11. All right, you're to worship the Creator, and these are all the things that He created. And when did He do it? He did it during the creation week. And how did He worship? How did He celebrate? How did He memorialize? He kept the Sabbath day. He rested on the Sabbath day, and He blessed it, particular blessing. And notice in verse 12, there is a special blessing for the saints who die in the Lord henceforth. And there is a special blessing for those who worship the Creator according to the Creator's own day. So this is a message which is to be spread worldwide, and it is to be spread to worship the Creator. And what better way in which to worship the Creator than on the Creator's own day? May God bless you as you continue to celebrate this Sabbath and all of your Sabbath, and keep the commandment according to the Ten Commandments written by the finger of God on Mount Sinai.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.